We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovix. Joining me today is John Rubino, former Wall Street financial analyst and author or co-author of 5 books, including The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops. He founded the popular financial website dollarcollapse.com in 2004 and sold it in 2022. And he now publishes on Substack at rubino.substack.com. John, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Tom. Great to talk to you again.
So, John, you know, you and I spoke just before Christmas last time. And I'd like to start by discussing a little bit about how really it's become a lot sexier to be a gold bug again since then.
Yeah, isn't it nice to be in an asset class that is in a bull market? It's been such a long time, you know. Gold had a basically a trading range for 3 or 4 years there where it go up to 2,000, get smacked back down and so on over and over again. And finally, it broke through 2000, so that that's now support. And then we don't know where resistance is yet, you know, 2400. Yeah, that seems like where resistance is. And if it breaks through there, then maybe it's off to the races. So here's hoping that gold stays strong and that it pulls silver along for the ride and that that we have a really fun 2024.
Well, I think it will be, you know, hopefully it'll be a fun 2024 and not a scary 2024, but it'll be interesting to see how this market really develops, right? Like, we have spent so much time theorizing and hoping for this day to come. And now that it's finally here, I think it's quite interesting to be able to, on one hand, apply the lessons that we've learned and we have thought about for so long. And on the other hand, learn from this bull market and what it has to teach us.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things that it is hopefully teaching us is that when something is misvalued, sometimes it takes a really long time to get back to intrinsic value, but it eventually does. Mm-hmm. And with gold and silver, gold in particular, the intrinsic value is probably $5,000 to $10,000 an ounce. That's based on the analysis that a lot of people have done on what price gold would have to be in order to 40% back the US dollar. In other words, if we went back to a gold standard at the backing that used to prevail during the classical gold standard, we'd need gold to be $10,000 an ounce, which is to say the dollar would then be a name for 1/10,000th of an ounce of gold. And I think that is where we're headed. And it's just taking a lot longer than it seems like it should have, you know, and it's nice to be in that heading in that direction, though. And hopefully, once it gets going, then it becomes a hot asset class where momentum traders come in. And that's usually the tail end of a bull market is something like that, where people who didn't really know much about the asset just see it moving. It shows up on their momentum screens and they jump aboard the trend. And that provides the parabolic move at the very end when, like in the 1970s, when gold went from a few hundred dollars an ounce to $800 an ounce in the blink of an eye, and silver went from a few dollars an ounce to $50 an ounce. So hopefully we've got something like that out there to get us to the point where gold and silver are just fairly valued, you know, and then we can think about maybe lightening up a little bit. But until then, it's nice to ride along. Mm-hmm.
John, you know, you said that is the direction that we're headed in a possibly in a gold-backed US dollar direction. Is that what you meant by that? Like, what problems would backing the US dollar to gold solve?
Well, I meant that we were heading in the direction of intrinsic value, okay, as measured by. But yeah, I think at some point, the financial system as it's currently set up breaks down, because mm-hmm. you're seeing debt at every level of most major societies just go parabolic now. And you can't do that for very much longer without the interest costs eating you alive, unless you move interest rates back down to negative territory where they were for a while there. But that we found out in 2020. Generates massive inflation when you do something like that. So there's no real way out of this other than some kind of a currency reset at some point. Mm-hmm. And if it happens, under crisis situation or under crisis conditions, then I think people would go for the safe and already tested solution, which would be a gold standard, because we've done that. You know, we kind of know how it works technically. And if you're under a huge amount of pressure and the world is chaotic, you may not want to try something that's brand new that might have side effects that you don't understand. So that would be the thing standing in the way of a crypto standard. If we decided to use Bitcoin, for instance, as the base layer of the global monetary system, that would be a choice when the time comes. But it would also be kind of a leap into the unknown, because the people running the monetary system, in other words, the central bankers of the world and the treasury officials of the world, they would have to make that decision. And they would be, you know, faced with one that is kind of understandable, even if it seems primitive, and another that seems, modern and technological and maybe workable, but maybe not, you know? So I think there's a decent chance that we try the gold standard next time as our next monetary system after this one breaks down. So then it becomes a question of how many years from here does it take to get there? And what, if you're invested in gold and silver and related mining stocks, what's the trajectory of that move, you know? And I wouldn't even pretend to have an idea about the timing of all this, except to say that we can't keep going like we're going now. You know, you look at the interest expense that the U.S. dollar or that the U.S. government is experiencing right now, and it's going straight up. We went from a few hundred billion dollars a year to $1 trillion a year. And the projection going forward is for $1.6 trillion a year in 2025. That's a death spiral. Mm-hmm. Because you got to borrow the money that you use to pay your interest expense, which then that has to be, that generates interest costs, which makes your overall interest expense even higher, and so on, and until it just spins out of control. And I would, you know, based on common sense, I would say we're pretty close to that, because when numbers are already huge and they're going straight up, you just don't have much longer to go with that kind of a trend. So I think we're close, you know, mm-hmm. without wanting to specify a date or anything.
Of course. You know, one quick point on what you were saying there. I feel like, you know, central banks in a lot of ways have already voted with what they're actually holding as assets, right? Gold is a massive part of their reserves. And at this point, cryptocurrency is not. And that's not to say that there isn't a place for that. But, you know, at this point in a monetary system shift, gold seems to be, you know, one of those neutral reserve assets that is recognized worldwide. But, you know, as you're mentioning this explosion in debt, explosion in the monetary base, what happens, you know, you wrote a recent article explaining what really happens to the demand for treasuries and bonds in this scenario. Where does that appetite for those bonds come from if they're issuing far more than the market or than the, let's say, the international market has appetite for?
Well, that's a really big question, because who does buy? For instance, the U.S. is scheduled to issue $10 trillion of treasury paper this year. Mm-hmm. And somebody has to buy that paper by definition. Mm-hmm. But who's doing that? Because China is just not happy with dollar hegemony, and they're looking for alternatives. And they're the big Chinese central bank is the big whale in the gold market right now. They're buying a lot of gold, and that's in part that's what's propelling the bull market right now. So you can't really count on China to buy a bunch of treasury bonds, which the proceeds from which we're going to use to build up our military to possibly start World War III with China. You know, it's not in their best interest to do that, is it? Mm-hmm. And it's not clear who else would be the big buyer of those treasury bonds. So it could end up being the Fed again, which means we could go back to basically MMT, you know, modern monetary theory, where we just create the currency out of thin air and run the government with it. And we have this intermediate step of issuing bonds and the Fed buying the bonds. But it's make-believe, you know, that we're basically financing the government with newly created currency. In which case, that comes back to affect the value of the dollar via inflation. It makes prices go up, the dollar goes down. Now, at the same time, though, that's not a collapse of the dollar scenario, because there's so much dollar-denominated debt out there that the demand for dollars to pay the interest on all those debts that are out there supports the dollar, because so many people need it. So there's demand for dollars. There are buyers out there. Mm-hmm. So the dollar doesn't go away as a reserve currency and a medium of exchange. It just it loses value via inflation, and it gains some competition from other currencies that become useful in trade. Like the BRICS countries are starting to use their own currencies for bilateral trade, and that basically is competition for the dollar. So that those are trends that are kind of in place, and they're kind of moving. You know, the dollar is going to get some competition. It's being inflated away, but it's being supported by demand from other sources, and so we've got that kind of set of cross currents that are out there. Mm-hmm. And they probably add up to the dollar staying around, but there having to be a currency reset at some point where we still have something called the dollar. It's just defined differently, maybe in terms of some other asset like gold. And that's good if you own gold, and bad if you trust the government by holding a lot of dollars in bank accounts or in government bond funds, because the value of a government bond, for instance, depends on the value of the currency. So if we're inflating away the dollar, that means we're by definition making government bonds that are denominated in dollars and pay interest in dollars less valuable. So it's completely possible that we see as part of this process, we see a bond bear market in the US, which is the same thing as saying interest rates go up. And that kind of sparks the final crisis, because if interest rates start going up, that means interest costs, spiking though they are, will spike even faster. And you'll see Japan, which is in the worst shape as far as government interest costs potentially goes, we'll see them go first, and then the US will have a crisis, and then Europe will also have a crisis. And it'll be one of those things where the dominoes start knocking each other down. We can't know for sure which goes first, but I would put my money on Japan being the first big crisis in this kind of a scenario. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I appreciate you kind of handling both sides of that and illustrating or illuminating both of those, countervailing forces, because it's not just a one-way street here of the dollar being inflated into oblivion. This is a problem and a scenario that is going to take time to play out. And as you said, I don't think that anybody really knows which domino falls first and in which order, whether that be Japan, Europe, then the States, or how that ends up playing out. But, John, as we're thinking about, let's say, inflation from a 5,000 foot view, do you think that at this point, we can say that the monetary authorities at the central banks around the world have gotten a handle on inflation?
No, I think inflation has diminished some lately as interest rates have gone up. Mm-hmm. But you know what? It's not going back down into, for instance, the Fed's target range at all. It's depending on which measure you use, it's 3-ish% up to around 8% for some of the core metrics that we use to measure inflation. And that's according to our basically debased statistical techniques for measuring inflation right now. Because if you use the method that we used to measure inflation in the 1980s and apply that to today's world, then inflation is something like twice what the government is reporting right now. So in real terms, or in legitimate terms, inflation is absolutely not under control. And because interest rates are higher, which is making interest costs higher, there's a lot of pressure on governments to lower interest rates to get their interest costs under control. But you can't do that if inflation is two or three times the generally accepted target range for the central banks of the world. So they're in a box that there really isn't any solution for here, because if they address interest costs, it'll come at the cost of higher inflation. Mm-hmm. But then higher inflation leads to higher interest expense and higher interest rates. So you're right back where you started. And there doesn't seem to be any way out of this now. We're finally there. You know, the gold bugs of the world have been talking about this for years, if not decades, that there would be a time when central banks had painted themselves into a corner that they can't get out of, because whatever they do causes a crisis somewhere. And then it becomes just a choice of crises. You know, which kind of pain are you going to have to eat? You know, we're going to have a 1930s style deflationary crash or a Weimar Germany hyperinflation. And how soon are you going to bring that about? You know, and that's basically where we kind of are now. Japan is a really good example of this, because the yen is starting to fall versus the dollar. It was, there were about 110 yen to the dollar 5 years ago. Now it's 150 some. And that is inflationary for Japan. And their debt is continuing to rise at an accelerating rate. So their interest rates are now going up in response to the yen falling. And that increases the interest costs for the government, which puts them in that box that we've been talking about, you know, where if they try to support the currency, keep it from just becoming a disorderly decline, they have to raise interest rates to do that. But then the government's interest expense goes through the roof and the government risks going bankrupt. So there isn't really a fix. And that's why we should be watching Japan, because that's kind of an example of where we're all headed. We're all going to be in that place in the not too distant future. And the way it goes for Japan is the way it will go for a lot of other countries. So pay attention to them, because the way the yen is falling, we might get some kind of a resolution pretty soon here where they make their choice. And then we see what the effect of that choice is, whether it's a deflationary crash or some kind of rising inflation scenario. And then we'll know that that's where we're all headed in the not too distant future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always an interesting scenario to try to understand whether the central bank of whatever country it's going to be decides to sacrifice their currency or their bond market. And, you know, I had a recent discussion with Simon Hunt, where he kind of illustrated both of those examples. And as you did as well, you know, this example of Japan and seeing them trying to keep their peg at 120, or, you know, as that number has gone up, and, you know, backstop their bond market as well. This is a teeter-totter that I think at the end of the day, as you've said, is impossible to really manage. But, you know, John, when we kind of take a step back here and we try to really get a feel for this devaluation of our currency or the inflationary nature of this monetary system, how does that affect the investments and the places that people are actually invested? You know, if we take the example of, for example, the stock market or, you know, real estate, being invested in real estate, if we adjust some of those numbers for inflation, does that paint a very different picture for the value of those assets over time?
Yeah, almost everything. If you adjust it for inflation, and our inflation has been pretty high historically lately, then that means the return you got on that asset was a lot less impressive than you thought it was. And we kind of have to think in those terms, because if we don't think in real terms, then we really don't know how our investments are doing, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, a bond that yields 3% in an inflationary environment of 4% is actually losing you 1% in real terms. Your capital is shrinking in real terms. And that's been the case for the bond market for quite a while now. There was a while there when interest rates were like 1% or zero or negative in a lot of other cases. You know, a negative yielding bond is guaranteed to shrink your capital over time. They're going to give, you know, they're going to pay you, or no, you're going to pay them while you own the bond, and they're going to then give you back less in real terms than you gave them to begin with. And that's how an economy basically zeroes itself out. You know, it ceases to exist if its capital base is shrinking over time. And in inflation-adjusted terms, a lot of the bond market has been doing that over the past few years. So yeah, you got to pay attention to that. Now, if you look at gold, for instance, it's done a really good job of offsetting monetary inflation. It was, what, $280 an ounce at the beginning of the century. Now it's 2000 and change. And that pretty much offsets the decline in the purchasing power of the dollar with a little bit left over. So gold did its job very well. You know, it's not supposed to spike and make everybody rich. It's supposed to protect the purchasing power of the people who own it. Mm-hmm. And so going forward, we should expect it to continue to do that, with that parabolic pop at the end when everybody jumps into it because they think that it's going to the moon and that's what's going to protect them. And it doesn't matter what you pay for it. You know, there will be kind of a bubble aspect to the precious metals market if it goes the way it has in the past. You know, in the 1970s, it did it. Mm-hmm. And in 2008 or to 2011 or so, it kind of did the same thing where people were buying it without understanding it. They were just buying it because it was moving. And that made it move in a way that an inflation hedge really shouldn't move, you know, and that's coming. So so the takeaway from that is don't sell your gold too soon, you know. Wait for that parabolic move at the end and then hand it off to the people who don't understand it at some really nice multiple of what you paid for it. So mm-hmm. I think, yeah, you know, I think personally it's got to be $5,000 an ounce where before I start wanting to lighten up at all, and maybe not even then, depending on what's happening in the world. Mm-hmm. So I think the stackers are in a pretty good place right now because they've been accumulating gold and silver a little at a time for a long time. Average price is way lower than today's price, in gold's case at least. And they're looking at the really sweet part of the cycle now, where even though there could be a correction in between now and then, the last part of this cycle is going to be parabolic, and in which case you make multiples of what you you put into your stack. So it's going to be nice to feel smart and see how that plays out. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's always interesting, and I think important to consider how gold acts as an inflation hedge over this longer period of time. Of course, you know, these timelines are, I think, absolutely really important to be able to understand the investment case for gold, but it's not, you know, a 1 year or, you know, quick in and out trade. It is a ballast, let's say, over time. But John, when we think about all of the drivers, the price drivers right now for gold, do you think that the geopolitical tensions are one of the most important components to driving, you know, the average person to have gold come onto their radar?
Well, yeah. You know, when you start thinking about safety because you're afraid of what you're seeing out in the world, gold is one of the things that pops up from an investment standpoint, because it's basically maintained its value for 3,000 years, you know, and there's a lot of crazy stuff has happened in those 3,000 years, and gold has always been valuable. So yes, money flows into gold and to a lesser extent silver when geopolitics is really unsettled, and it is incredibly unsettled right now. You know, we are not far from World War III. One stupid mistake or one, you know, big policy change from here. Like, for instance, Europe sending soldiers to Ukraine, which they're talking about doing right now. That's the kind of thing. Or the U.S. bombing Iran to defend Israel. You know, we've got things that are being discussed out there right now that would start World War III, in which case, you know, it's possible that it doesn't matter what we're invested in because we're all going to be incinerated. But it's also completely possible that World War III is very destabilizing to other parts of the world, and it causes oil prices to go to $150 an ounce and inflation to spike. In other words, we get another version of the 1970s. So we don't all kill each other, but we mess up our monetary systems in a really profound way, in which case gold is exactly what you want to own in that kind of a situation. So yeah, and a big part of the central bank buying, I think, is being driven by these same geopolitical concerns. If you're a central bank in some part of the world where you might be affected by geopolitical turmoil, you know, you might actually be sucked into World War III, who knows? You don't want to own currencies that would be inflated away by the combatants. You want something for your reserve asset that is neutral. You know, it's not making a political statement to own gold. It's just buying something that's going to hold its value over a long period of time. And in an unsettled geopolitical situation, there's more of an incentive to own something like gold than in normal peaceful times. So that could be driving part of the central bank buying that's happening right now. And they're whales. I mean, they're such big players in gold right now, that if it's true that they're buying gold in part because they're worried about what's going on in the world, then the fact that geopolitics is getting even scarier might lead to even more gold buying. So that's a real possibility in the next couple of years, that we have these whales in the market on top of everything else that really drive precious metals demand. And at that point, you know, they're not really that price sensitive because they want protection. And so you combine central banks who are kind of panic buying gold with momentum traders who are buying it because it's showing up on their momentum charts. And then you get a lot of demand out there in a market that's really not that big. There's not all that much extra gold sitting around to satisfy new demand because, you know, there's plenty of gold out there, but a lot of it is in places that that you're not going to empty out because gold went up by another $100 an ounce. You know, the central banks who are buying right now are not going to turn around and sell. A lot of the jewelry out there is family heirlooms and has sentimental value, and people aren't just going to bring that into the pawn shop, although some people are doing that now. But a big part of the jewelry in the world is not going to be sold just because gold goes to $2,500 an ounce or something like that. So you won't see all that much new supply coming in to meet this new demand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in times like that, you get a disorderly market to the upside.
On the other side of, you know, this geopolitical question mark that we all have at this point, John, you know, how do you think about the risk of, you know, some type of the next financial panic? Do you have a feeling for what could be the next crisis that could spark the Fed to reverse course and, you know, start printing lower rates again? Like, you know, we saw the end of the BTFP program for the banks that was instituted just over a year ago. We saw that come to an end. There were people that were concerned about the banks. We have, you know, this commercial real estate crash. I saw a building the other day on my Twitter feed that was sold in 2006 for something like $150 million. And it was sold just the other day for, I think, $3 million. You know, there's all these types of bubbles or shaky foundations within this financial world. Do you have a feeling or a hunch on which one of them that you think is quite unstable at this point?
Oh, there are a bunch. Well, that, you know, that's why they call it the everything bubble, because there are maybe five things out there that can blow up and in a much bigger way than subprime mortgages did in 2007, and then start knocking down all the other dominoes. So you mentioned, I think, the best one, or the most likely one, where commercial real estate, which has massive embedded losses in it, starts having to report those losses. And then it turns out that a lot of those assets are on bank balance sheets, which means local and regional banks have to start reporting those losses. That spooks their depositors who start pulling money out. Mm-hmm. That crashes those banks. That leads the government to have to come in and bail out not just Silicon Valley Bank and two others, but 3,000 local and regional banks. And that's several trillion dollars, which spooks the currency markets and so on. You know, you get kind of a cascade failure of the financial system in that case. And then another one is an equities crash here. One of those stock markets again, where, you know, there's all these headlines with bad breath in the headline. And that's because the stock market is being supported by just a handful of what look like one decision stocks, companies that are going to just grow forever and you can buy their stock for any price. And it was like that in 1999 with the tech stock bubble. It was like that in 2006, 2007 with the housing bubble. And now it's like that with what they call the Magnificent Seven, you know, the seven gigantic tech stocks that that are supporting everything else out there. In the past, those stocks tanked, and they could easily do that again. You know, NVIDIA, you know, how do you value NVIDIA? It could drop by 50% and still be a richly valued tech stock. When something like that happens, it pulls down everything else, and you get an equities bear market. And that spooks everybody else, forces governments to start cutting interest rates in order to keep an equities bear market from turning into a 1929 style hyper crash that affects the rest of the global financial system. And there we go. You know, the governments are back to cutting interest rates. That's leading to inflation in some parts of the economy. That's leading to a currency crisis and yada, yada. You know, it is easy to envision these two crises and several other crises. And, you know, it could be that the biggest one is geopolitical too, where they spike oil to $150 a barrel because we start bombing Iran. And then that causes costs go up. Now, that's incredibly inflationary if energy costs go way up. Mm-hmm. And then in spiking inflation crashes the bond market. So, yeah, there's lots of ways it could happen. And basically all of them can be protected against with a few fairly simple strategies. You know, shorting the market is pretty good insurance right now. This is one of those incipient big short scenarios where, you know, don't go put all your money into shorting tech stocks or anything, but short some of them as insurance. You know, you can use options, put options to short the NASDAQ. And that gives you some protection against a crash. And obviously, gold and silver and the mining stocks will do well in the inflationary versions of these crises. So real assets like gold and silver and extremely well-chosen real estate, maybe some farmland and then maybe some strategic shorts. And you've got a portfolio that is reasonably well-protected against most of the scenarios out there. So, you know, the meta version of this or the meta explanation for it is that it's basically a shift in capital away from financial assets that depend on the currencies for their value and into real assets that have utility. You know, they're valuable because they're useful and governments can't just make more of them out of thin air. So now, if you haven't already been doing that, is a good time to start shifting your finances, I think, in that direction.
You know, John, you mentioned silver earlier, like, as you said, that these drivers are going to push people into gold and to an extent silver as well. You know, considering the dynamics that we saw during the silver squeeze in 2020, is it possible that the supply side imbalances have only gotten more favorable for a short squeeze?
Well, yeah, according to the Silver Institute, and, you know, we don't really know for sure what the inner workings of the silver market are like, but the Silver Institute has some insight. And they've said that the last 2 years, there's been a deficit in the silver market. In other words, the world's mines are not producing enough silver to meet the demand from fabricators like, you know, solar panel makers and electric car makers. And investors who want to buy silver coins and silver bars. And, you know, that can't go on forever, obviously, because if you're using more than you're making, eventually you run out. And then prices have to go way up to bring things back into balance. So what's interesting right now about that is the Silver Institute just released their new projections for 2024. And it's for an even bigger deficit than in the previous 2 years. And the previous 2 years were pretty big. So the deficit in the silver market is getting bigger. And the question is, at what point does that turn into a shortage, an actual shortage, where people just can't get the silver that they need and they have to pay way up? And we don't know that for sure, although one analyst just did come out and say 12 to 24 months and we're out of above ground silver. You know, I wouldn't want to put my name on that prediction or anything, because I have no idea what the methodology is for figuring out how much above ground silver there is out there. But it's interesting to see a mainstream analyst coming out with that kind of a number, because if it's that soon, then we're looking at maybe a default on the COMEX, one of the other metals exchanges, where they just don't have silver to meet futures contract demand, and they have to pay with cash instead. So they won't just, you know, totally stiff the guy with the long futures contract who wants delivery, but they won't give him the silver. They'll just give him cash instead. And that's going to be seen as a real default for the markets, you know? So in that kind of a situation, silver would go straight up, because people would know that if they want it, they got to pay whatever they have to pay to get it. And there are industries out there who would do that to an extent. And there are investors who would go, you know, momentum crazy and do that. And so you might get this straight up spike, not even a kind of a parabolic thing where it goes up at an increasing arc. It would just go straight up, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's happened with Bitcoin lately and Ethereum and several other commodities, where you have this big spike because there's a fear of a shortage. And that could easily happen with silver. So it's about time. We've waited a long time for silver to start behaving well again. And it could be that we'll be rewarded big time by something really discontinuous at some point.
Yeah, I think, you know, to your point about if we don't get a physical delivery on a COMEX contract, you know, one might not make too big of a splash. But, you know, if it happens to 5 contracts or 10 contracts, I think that's when, you know, that confidence really starts to come out of that system.
Yeah. And well, I think even, you know, any kind of a default like that would be something that we would talk about. So the internet would explode if there was even one contract on the COMEX that was defaulted upon. So, but you're right. If all the other ones got satisfied, then it wouldn't be as big a deal as if it just, you know, COMEX just stopped giving silver to people and just started paying cash for everything. So we don't know, you know, how big the default would be. But if it's one of the bigger ones, that would be a huge deal for silver. And you know, again, I have no idea how everybody gets the numbers that they're getting in that market, because who knows where silver is out there. You know, people, as you said before we went live here, a lot of people have silver that they don't want anybody else to know about. So how does an analyst figure out how much is out there? So we need to take those numbers as rough estimates at best. But, you know, I definitely got to say, I like seeing those estimates out there. And if they turn out to be right, then really extreme things are going to happen in the precious metals markets in the not too distant future.
Mm-hmm. Where do we see a lot of this industrial demand coming from for silver right now, John?
Well, solar is a big deal because solar panels, you know, a lot of clean tech has turned out really not to work. Electric cars are not booming the way everybody expected that they would. And wind power is turning out to have a lot of potentially fatal flaws. And even solar isn't doing as well as people expected, but it's still something that is viable. You know, if your power costs go up and you're in a sunny place, you can slap solar panels on your roof and get a good return on investment that way. So solar is continuing to grow. Solar panels, the new generation of solar panels actually use more silver per panel than the old generation did. So demand is rising, you know, and that's fairly new. There wasn't a big solar panel component to silver demand 5 years ago. And now it's arguably the biggest industrial sector for silver. And then you've got artificial intelligence, which is going to be a massive driver of electricity demand going forward, apparently. You know, there's an estimate the other day that that said just 1 year's worth of chip production from NVIDIA, if they're all plugged in and used, is going to demand as much electricity as Ireland does. And that's 1 year, you know? And so AI is going to require massive amounts of power out there. And there's a silver component to that too. You know, silver will be used in that process. And that's brand new. You know, we didn't have AI on any kind of a scale 2 years ago. And now it's bigger than Ireland, you know? And so the industrial demand for silver is going to be pretty serious. And if you then look at the investment, with gold going up, that makes silver more attractive for investors because, you know, gold at $1,500 an ounce. Let me approach that a different way. When gold goes up relative to silver, then silver becomes more attractive when investors are thinking, well, look, here's how much a Krugerrand costs. But with the price of that Krugerrand, I can get this pile of silver, you know, and that would be gorgeous. I want to, you know, put it on my table and look at it. And, you know, there's a kind of almost an erotic aesthetic thing with precious metals for people. And I think a lot of people just envision how much silver they can get when gold gets really expensive for the same money. And that's part of what drives silver's outperformance during precious metals bull markets. Gold goes up first, and then silver looks relatively cheap, and people start buying silver. So, you know, we got a situation here where the demand for silver industrially is high and rising, and gold is going up, which means that the investor demand for silver also has a tailwind. So it's possible that there's a time when you have everybody trying to get a hold of silver, and there just isn't enough silver to satisfy that demand at anything like today's prices. You know, it has to go up a long way from here to kill off some of that demand. And, you know, silver would have to go up a fair bit, for instance, to make it replaceable in solar panels. And it would have to go up also a fair bit to make investors no longer interested in it, because once it starts going up, you get momentum traders coming in. And so the investment demand, at least for a while, goes up because of prices going up for silver. So, yeah, I think there's a scenario out there where you get $100 and then maybe more on silver. And again, not next week. Don't mortgage your house and buy a bunch of silver, but continue to dollar cost average into it with the expectation that that you do really well with your stacking over time, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, nobody really knows the future, but this is starting to seem reasonable for silver because you've got so many different data points that are all pointing in the same direction.
John, you know, it seems like we've given the caveat of having been patient in this market for so long, and that this bull market has really taken its time to shake as many people out of it as it can and make, you know, almost make the market apathetic towards the precious metals. Do you think that investment demand is almost all but gone in the West at this point before, you know, it gets exciting enough for new people to jump back in or to jump in the first place?
I think 6 months ago, it was pretty minimal. And I think now it's starting to rise a little bit, but nothing compared to where it normally goes during the tail end of bull markets. Mm-hmm. So there's no mania or anything out there. There's just, hey, gold is up all of a sudden, and look how much silver you can get for the price of an ounce of gold right now. You know, that kind of mindset, I think, is out there. But it's there's not a lot of FOMO, you know, fear of missing out yet in this market. Because even with gold at 2,400, that pales next to what NVIDIA did just lately and what cryptocurrencies are doing right now. So gold still isn't exciting. And silver won't be exciting until gold is exciting. So there's a ways to go before, say, a momentum investor who has a choice of Bitcoin or NVIDIA or gold is going to look at gold and see a compelling case, right? So I think there's more that has to happen. but we're moving in the right direction now. Maybe we don't know what the number is that'll light a fire under momentum demand for gold, but 2,500 could be that number just because it's nice and round. You know, it's the human mind likes round numbers, mm-hmm. and 2,500 is the kind of number where you could have a battle between resistance and support. And then once it breaks through resistance, and then support melts away, then you get a nice run. And that's, you know, part of that is the momentum traders at 2,600 or whatever. You know, once they see that the big support or the big resistance has been broken, then that's a technical signal for them to start buying. And but again, you know, this is all fun to speculate about, but we should really see gold as money that we're accumulating, not because we think it's going to quadruple, but because it's going to hold its value in the face of rising inflation. So, you know, it's not a trade. Like you said, it's not a trade. It's money that you hold in place of dollars because you think gold will hold its value better than dollars do. And that means stack. Dollar cost average. Don't speculate. But if we do get a kind of parabolic thing at the end, enjoy, you know, it's a reward for your patience and for your, you know, EQ that you could control yourself and not speculate in a market like this.
Well, that's an excellent way to put it, John. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to check back in with you as this bull market develops. But I think that's a good place to kind of end today's interview. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we do?
Yeah, just a really quick psychological thing. The world is terrifying out there. And it's easy to look at the headlines and to really, you know, obsess of what you're seeing on Twitter and everything and let it be almost debilitating, because that's how crazy the world is now. If you just focus on the bad stuff that's happening there, it can be overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the things you can do to prepare for disturbing times, and especially the investment thesis here, it's potentially, or it's possible to get this right and to make a lot of money, to have the kind of capital to protect your friends and your family from when things really spin out of control. And that should be our goal. And when you look at it that way, it's psychologically a lot healthier, because you're pursuing a positive goal, which is to build capital that you're going to use to save the lives of the people who didn't build the capital who you want to help, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way you should approach this. Not as the world is spinning out of control, but, oh, the world is spinning out of control and look how much money I can make while it does that.
That's an excellent way to reframe it. And I appreciate you kind of bringing that to our minds as something to think about. John, is your Substack the best place to find a lot of your writing and research?
Yeah, I'm at rubino.substack.com. And it's a newsletter where we cover this with an emphasis on actionable ideas. In other words, what you can actually do about what's coming. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. John, I really appreciate your time today and look forward to checking back in with you in a little bit.
Thanks, Tom. Look forward to it.
Take care.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.